what they have been seeing on their television screens and their phones over the past more than 2 months.
First of all, thank you so much for having me on the show. I think what can only be described as a harrowing, heartbreaking, deep, painful grieving from the community, from the international community, globally, continuously watching the genocide unfold and daily seeing the bombardment of civilians being targeted, the killings. Even as I was in the cop bubble in the last couple of days, you know, every time I popped up to my social media to see what's happening in the rest of the world, just, you know, seeing in the aggression being increased in the West Bank, it's been a very difficult 2 months, and I think it's been a 2 months that I don't think the world will ever be able to recover from. And I think, but yeah, it's been nothing but heartbreaking, unjustified aggression, and we continue to call on the international communities to act.
There were protests held there too on the sidelines of COP28. I'll let you fill us in on that one a little later, but let me bring in Lamprini. I made a mention of that UN General Assembly resolution that was vetoed by the US, of course, expectedly an abstention from the UK. What was your takeaway as far as the isolation of the US, the UK, and a few other countries that went down that route, preventing a ceasefire from taking place?
I think the phrase you use in English is they had it coming, especially with this outrageous guy, the so-called diplomat that represents Israel, and the way he treats the UN and the Secretary General, and with 133 people working for the UN dead, don't forget that, with all those theatrics and all that cruel stupidity, I can tell you, and I know very well that from the UN, that lots of diplomats are outraged, not only by the genocide, not only by how the international law is treated, but also by the viciousness and the ruthlessness of the man and the Israeli representation in general. The UN is not anybody. It's a very certain body. Diplomacy is a world of its own, with lots of rules, with need of a special code of conduct. So here we have someone that destroys even the diplomatic approach, not only Gaza. And that's a very important problem for the whole of the world. Also, another thing that was interesting is the change of votes, because this was the second time, remember, that the General Assembly had to vote for a ceasefire. And for me, it was even more interesting to see the change of the vote of lots of countries, mine included, where the people took the streets in masses, although the governments were fiercely pro-Israeli. In the former General Assembly, Greece did not vote, like British did this time, Britain did this time. Before that, they even put the flag of Israel in our parliament, although we're a people in a grand majority pro-Palestinian. And the governments may have moved pro-Israeli, but the people are not like that. So Greece voting for a ceasefire shows where even the most friendly towards Israel governments are now. We have a big change, and we have an isolated Israel, of course, and U.S. And we had even people working in the White House yesterday, I think, 2 nights ago, in their time, getting out of the White House and saying that we need a ceasefire. People working in there.
And earlier so from the State Department as well, people who resigned over the same
thing. Resigned, yes.
Yeah. Let's pivot back to the COP28 bubble, as you described it. Despite that, I mean, there were protests, although the UAE does not allow protests, but for some reason it did. There were protests taking place during COP28. There was intersectionality between climate justice conversation as well as the Gaza crisis or the war on Gaza.
Yeah.
What was your takeaway from it? What did you see over there?
So I refer to myself as a climate justice campaigner. And climate justice fundamentally is a global call for the end of destruction, displacement of people and land, which of course perfectly fits into the experience of the Palestinian people. When you look at Gaza, for example, a young child growing up in Gaza has has lived this, their entire lives never having energy security, never mm-hmm. having water security, mm-hmm. And never having safety.
And their underwater resources being threatened, as Israel claims it's going to send seawater into the so-called tunnels.
Absolutely. And so so actually, when we talk about climate justice in these conversations, we're talking about justice for all. And so actually one of the most incredible and powerful things I felt at the COP this year, and it was my third COP, is seeing young people mobilize and the call for the end of the genocide in Palestine mm-hmm. continuously echo in different spaces. Now, the reason that we had multiple protests in the UAE is because the conference itself is a UN conference, mm-hmm. And therefore the UN, UNFCCC has its own guidelines, its own security, and its own procedures and protocols for any kind of protest that happens in any of its spaces. So yeah. It wasn't for UAE to make the call whether we do protests or not. It was for the UN.
And also so it's a country that normalized with Israel under the so-called yeah. Abraham Accords yes. during the Trump administration in the U.S.
Yes. But yeah, no, I think from the conference itself, there was a consistent reminder of what's happening in Palestine. There was mm-hmm. there was actions and activism and campaigns happening. And actually, the call for climate justice itself is very much intersectional in its practice and calls for understanding that any form of ethnic cleansing and genocide, whether it's indigenous communities in the Amazonia forest yeah. or it's the people of Palestine, the issues and the systems of oppression that exist there are very much the same, you know?
Exactly, yeah. Well, we mentioned the U.S. Let's hear from the Palestinian prime minister, who says that the U.S. government must now walk the walk, quote-unquote, and take specific steps toward what has been an elusive two-state solution, including applying pressure on the Israeli regime. Mohammed Shtia spoke ahead of U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan's visit to the region to meet with representatives of both Tel Aviv and Palestine. More on that coming up. The United States has shielded Israel against growing international calls for an immediate ceasefire, but is publicly disagreeing with its close ally on a post-war scenario. Shtia told reporters that it's time for the U.S. to deal more firmly with Israel. Let's hear more of what he had to say.
There are quite a number of issues that the United States can do. One is to call upon Israel to stop the war. The United States has been calling upon Israel to avoid killing civilians and so on. You cannot avoid killing civilians if you continue the war. And therefore, it was a pity that Washington actually vetoed a United Nations Security Council resolution that has to do with the ceasefire and so on. So we need immediate ceasefire. Second important issue, those who have not been killed by Israeli bombardment, they have been starving to death. And those who have not been killed either way, they have been dying because of their wounds. So we need international aid to get into Gaza, not only and limited to Rafah crossing. There are 5 entry points to Gaza that United States can pressure Israel to allow international aid to go into Gaza from these entry points. United States has been calling, and the President of the United States has been calling for a two-state solution on the borders of 1967. Kamala Harris, in her phone call also with our president, has reiterated the same thing. Every American official who arrives here to meet with us, they again repeat and repeat the same thing, that United States is for two states. Now that United States has talked the talk, we want Washington to walk the walk, meaning that we need specific measures to implement the two-state solution, not only believe in two states. So for us, there are a number of steps that Washington can do. For example, one, United States can allow the admission of Palestine as a member state in the United Nations. Second, United States can bilaterally recognize Palestine on the borders of 1967 in accordance with the policy of the administration. And third important issue, United States can take the lead on the implementation of the two-state solution to mandate the Security Council to put together a timetable for Israel to end its occupation to the Palestinian territory.
Lambrini, you heard the Palestinian Prime Minister there. To them, at least, the way forward is clear. What is needed, first and foremost, is, at least in his opinion, American leadership. Yet, it's not there. And if there is, it's all in favor of the Israeli regime. It's a government in power at the moment that does not even believe in that type of a solution. We heard their ambassador to the UK say just a couple of nights ago on British TV that the so-called two-state solution was dead and that there was no way that there could ever be a Palestinian state.
I saw her, and it's another one of the Palestinian, of the Israeli diplomats that are not diplomats. I mean, I don't know where they learn how to be diplomats there, but they need to reassess everything that has to do with their schools. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's impossible. What we hear, all those genocidal maniacs are supposed to be diplomats. Just, it's incredible. And I have to say something more, if you allow me. It's not only the U.S. that has to walk the walk, it's the EU that has to walk the walk too. Because we are good in talking, sometimes, mm-hmm. not always, but there's nothing done. Israel is the major trading partner of Israel is the EU. They can do a lot of things if they want to do them.
Yeah. And, you would have expected more from Brussels, the summit that the EU member states were having in Brussels. A lot of focus on Ukraine, of course. They did address Gaza, with the Irish PM saying the institution stands to lose credibility if they don't adopt a firm position on the matter. And all we heard was that they were concerned about the loss of civilians and nothing beyond that.
They had to focus on Gaza, not on Ukraine only, not address Gaza. We have a problem there at start. Now, the Irish people, they're one of the few people in the EU who were colonized, were murdered, were oppressed. They have a totally different view from the rest of the countries. So the Irish leadership has to do more for the internal situation they had to face, for their audience in the country. The prime minister is already seen as not doing enough for Palestine. So we have a country that's different from the rest of the EU. There were only four countries, from what I read, that were strict on, we have to do something for Gaza. There's very few voices, really, in the EU. And EU showed in the last few years that it is a spineless entity. When it comes to international matters, international law, they don't care, unfortunately.
Zamzow, how do you see it? I mean, there's this almost fear of criticizing Israel among politicians from here in London, in the UK, across Europe, many European countries. In the United States, is it what so many people are calling Holocaust guilt? Mm. Is it the size of the UK, the Israeli economy, $500 billion to some estimates? What is it that is preventing these leaders from even criticizing Israel to get it to stop the slaughter of so many men, women, and children in Gaza and, of course, in the West Bank?
Mm. I think interesting what has happened very much so, which often almost happens in these crises, is that we try to draw parallels between what's happening in Ukraine to Gaza, for example. And actually that's a disservice to the onslaught that's happening to the Palestinian people for generations. Actually, I think what's more useful is to really unpack the historical and the structural reasons as to why Israel has been able to do what it's able to do, right?
Yeah.
And so actually, if we understand who is upholding these structures themselves, the UK, the US, Europe, are the architects of these oppressive regimes who have literally handed over, so the British Protectorate handed over, you know, the lands, the Palestinian land to the Israelis. So actually, they're upholding the very structures that they created.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a reason as to why the US are so heavily invested in ensuring that Israel succeeds, right? And there are political reasons, there are financial reasons. There's so many reasons that underline and underpin why Israel has been able to move forward in the way it has and completely be untouched and unscathed when it comes to breaking international law.
And there's also the question of complicity.
Absolutely.
So for historical reasons and for the decisions that they are taking on a daily basis now, is it fair to conclude that they are complicit in the crimes that the Israeli regime is committing against the Palestinians?
Absolutely. I don't think there's a doubt in my mind on that.
All right. Lamprini, on the humanitarian situation in Gaza, it is obviously sickening. We're seeing children losing limbs and lives, of course. Entire bloodlines, around 1,000 of them, having been wiped off the face of the earth in the past more than 2 months. Can you draw us a picture of what you think will be some of the biggest issues that will be facing the Gazans as we move forward if this war on Gaza continues?
First of all, you saw the numbers probably about hunger, that most of the families do not eat every day. The people that are there, there are families that do not eat for 2 and 3 days because the humanitarian aid is not allowed to get into Gaza and the needs of Gaza are not covered. And then we talk about the children, the women. I saw another number that today it really freaked me out. 4,000 students, university students, Palestinians, were killed. That's the future of Palestine, murdered in front of our eyes. Not only a generation, but the future, the ones who will take those people out of poverty, the doctors, the people who will fight with law, the lawyers, for their rights. I mean,
yeah.
4,000 students, it's unimaginable. It's one of the big universities in Greece has about 4,000 students. We're a small country, but I mean, you cannot realize what it means. You're thinking about it, 4,000 people before their 25th year studying to give something to their own. You know, it's impossible. And why? Because they're fighting against colonialism, for freedom, for self-determination, for everything that the international law says they have to fight and says that we have to help them to fight for.
Yeah.
I mean, it's raw barbarism. It's something that we have never seen before. And I think I told you that. I've seen wars. I've seen civil wars in Africa.
Yeah.
Nothing like that even there.
We're approaching Christmas, the Christmas period. It is a period that is dear to many people across the globe, especially in relation to the Palestinians, surely. The bombing carrying on seems even more inhumane, but a swift end, as we've been describing over the past hour, seems unlikely.
And you see that the churches, all the Christian churches in Palestine, decided not to celebrate this year. I mean, the liturgies all happened, but only that. And, of course, you saw the picture of little Jesus, Palestinian little Jesus, in the rubbles that the Lutheran church put there. It's awful. And because most of the Palestinian Christians are Orthodox, like us, like the Greeks, we feel even more embarrassed by this, not celebrating, not being able to see the most the biggest news for us as that, but only having tears and destruction and hunger and disease and that murderous regime of Bibi Netanyahu on you. I would like to add something, if you don't mind. AIPAC
briefly,
is a very... Yes, very briefly. AIPAC is the only foreign agent who is not a foreign, doesn't have to register as a foreign agent in the United States. And that tells a lot.
There sure is. And Zamzam, I'll ask you a second question later, but since you're a climate activist, there's a real concern here about the landscape of Gaza, the destruction of all the buildings, the carpet bombing, the physical environment destroyed, the subterranean aquifer in danger, white phosphorus, accusations of that having been used, other toxins as a result of the explosions. What is it going to look like post-bombardment? How do you explain that in environmental terms?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the messaging that's been coming out of of Israeli government and pinkwashing, whitewashing, greenwashing,
completely.
And actually, if you look at what has happened within Gaza specifically, not even looking outside of it, but Gaza specifically, and you look at how the land has been completely leveled, and actually land that was known to be infertile, very fertile land, is now probably unable to be used and unable to be rebuilt on. And that is complete destruction of the environment. It's everything that they say they stand for, and so it's very, very heartbreaking to see not only the destruction of people, communities, lands, and ancestry, but also the very foundational land that we need and we have conversations about.
And if you look at satellite images, you can see the difference.
Yes.
You know, the purpose here is to make Gaza uninhabitable, just like a post-nuclear blast situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And to think that we are having a conversation about if this is a humanitarian crisis or not, it's heartbreaking. It's ridiculous
to call a pause humanitarian.
Yeah. No, absolutely not.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. And with those comments, we're going to wrap up this show. Many thanks again to my guests for their contributions. Gaza Under Attack will be back with more. Until then, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. The number of UK companies going bust jumped by almost a fifth in October compared with a year earlier, as the toll of high interest rates and falling sales hit struggling businesses in Britain. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to one of UK's biggest insolvency practitioners, higher interest rates are pushing an increasing number of companies into insolvency. Begbie's trainer said it expected to see more businesses tip into insolvency in tandem with the indicators of corporate financial stress in the United Kingdom. The Bank of England has raised interest rates from 0.1% at the end of 2021 to 5.25% to try to tame inflation. That has significantly increased the cost of borrowing for British businesses, preventing many from papering over the cracks with cheap debt. Interest rate increases also have the effect of reducing spending in the economy, giving indebted companies little way out. Rick Trainer, the executive chair of Begbie's Trainer, said the company had seen an increase in insolvency numbers reflecting the current interest rate and inflation environment. The company's revenues from insolvencies rose by 17%, and it said that corporate distress levels continue to increase. Economies expect Britain's recent weak economic performance to continue into 2024. Forecasts from professional economists compiled by the Treasury suggest Britain's gross domestic product will grow by only 0.5% in 2024, the same rate as in 2023. Although suggesting the United Kingdom will avoid a recession, the level of economic growth would remain far short of the 2% annual average before the financial crisis of 2008. According to data from the Insolvency Service, The number of corporate insolvencies in the year to September 30th increased by 17% to 24,326. Begbie's trainer said that increase had largely been from liquidations, which tend to be requested by smaller companies, but added that administrations were also approaching pre-pandemic levels after a period in which companies were given more leeway on some debts. Administrators tend to be called in to larger, more complex businesses. Insolvency practitioners have a real-time insight into the pressures facing businesses, although they, by contrast, tend to benefit from an increase in work when times are tough for the wider economy. Begbie's trainer said it had increased staff numbers by 12% over the past year to cope with the expected influx of new business. The company reported a resilient performance in its financial advisory business as more companies sought to refinance or restructure their businesses. That made up for a decline in revenues from investments or mergers and acquisitions, with fewer businesses feeling able to spend. The website Reddit has also covered the same story. The number of UK companies going bust jumped by almost a fifth in October compared with a year earlier, as the toll of high interest rates and falling sales hit struggling businesses in Britain. The insolvency service said 2,308 firms in England and Wales collapsed in October, which was 19% more than in October of 2022. And higher than pre-pandemic levels. Construction companies, retailers and manufacturing firms headed the list of sectors most affected by firms becoming insolvent. The retailer Wilko, which went into administration on 10th of October and has subsequently collapsed with a loss of 12,500 jobs and 400 stores, is expected to signal further company insolvencies in the remainder of the year. The industry body, R3, said corporate insolvencies increased by 71% from October of 2021's total of 1,347 and by 69% compared with pre-pandemic levels in October of 2019. The insolvency service said one of the biggest drivers was action by the tax authority HMRC, which has increased the number of winding up orders for unpaid tax in recent months. A breakdown of the figures showed the increase was mostly due to a rise in creditors' voluntary liquidations, in which a company is voluntarily wound up either by its directors or its shareholders. There were 1,880 creditors' voluntary liquidations last month, 13% higher than in October of 2022. The number of administrations which allow an insolvency practitioner to take over the running of a firm, usually to find a potential buyer, was also higher than in October of 2022. The HMRC and other creditors secured winding up orders for 221 compulsory liquidations in October, 45% higher than in October of last year. Insolvency practitioners said Britain had avoided the avalanche of companies going bust predicted in the months after the COVID-19 pandemic first hit in 2020, but was now seeing the effects of tighter and more costly lending on the finances of firms left vulnerable by the cost of living crisis. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a think tank, about 7,000 businesses are likely to fail every quarter in 2024 as high interest rates cause financial strain and Britain's economy enters recession. The Centre for Economics and Business Research said debt taken on during the pandemic higher borrowing costs and the cost of living crisis would drive an increasing number of businesses under, particularly in the retail and hospitality sectors. There were more than 6,700 business insolvencies in Britain in the second quarter of 2023, more than double in a typical quarter during the pandemic, when many businesses were largely protected from insolvency through a range of support measures. CEBR said insolvencies over the period were 50% higher than the same quarter pre-pandemic in 2019, and they averaged 4,100 on a quarterly basis between 2015 and 2019. The Bank of England has raised interest rates 14 times since the end of 2021, from 0.1% at the end of 2021 to the current 5.25%, heaping pressure on indebted households and businesses. The CEBR is forecasting two more rate increases in the current cycle, with bank rate peaking at 5.75%. The think tank said the worst is yet to come in terms of borrowing costs, quite apart from the impact of fixed-term loans made when interest rates were lower being rolled over at the new higher rates. It added, looking ahead to the future, the CEBR expects the rate of business insolvencies to remain high as interest rates continue to rise, pushing up debt repayments to unsustainable levels for some businesses. Our model suggests that there could be 7,000 insolvencies per quarter on average across 2024. Furthermore, CEBR is forecasting a recession in Britain, with two consecutive quarters of contraction in gross domestic product in the fourth quarter of 2023 and the first quarter of 2024.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu Alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, we're welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Farahzad. Stay tuned. One example regarding human's arrogance is the case of degrading and belittling others. This could happen in regard to both the people around or even God's creation. In our hadith collections, degrading Allah's creation or creature is very much condemned. People are not allowed to degrade anyone in Islam.
در روایت در اصول کافی است که لو یعلم الناس کیف خلق الله الخلق.
امام صادق علیه السلام in a beautiful hadith states, if people were fully aware of the mechanism of Allah's creation and the difference between the creation of humans, they would never condemn or degrade anyone. This hadith means that Allah created people with different capacities and talents. Since most of people are not aware about the main features of other people around themselves, they start belittling or degrading them. By degrading the creatures of Allah, we are degrading Allah, and this is a big sin. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Farhasad. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The Minister of Economy and Foreign Trade of Syria, Mohammed Samer al-Khalil, says 15-year negotiations between Syria and the Islamic Republic of Iran have now reached implementation stage. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered the story and tells us more. Syria's emergence from years of conflict and the expansion of stability and peace in most parts of the country have provided Iran with a chance to re-establish economic and commercial cooperation between Tehran and Damascus. After the destruction caused by years of war, Syria needs reconstruction. According to statistics, almost 40% of government and private buildings in Syria have been destroyed or seriously damaged. The agricultural sector, which accounts for 20% of the country's gross domestic product and 30% of the employment of workers, is in a bad shape. Sectors of serious industry, such as textiles, food and chemical products, which were once famous in West Asia and North Africa, are mostly in tatters. Almost all the industrial and infrastructure towns in the country have been damaged or destroyed during years of war. So much as 80% of the Sheikh Najjar industrial town, one of the most famous production areas in Syria, has been destroyed. Another area of crisis in Syria is the country's electricity generating sector and energy sector. Of the 39 electricity generating stations in the country, 15 have been completely destroyed and 10 electricity generating stations have been partially destroyed, and only one of 8 gas refineries is currently operating. Considering the potential, capacities and experience that Iran has in areas such as building construction, agriculture, planting, harvesting and conversion industries, construction of power plants and establishment of refineries and petrochemical industries, Iran is best placed to provide the basis for exporting and sending technical and engineering services to Syria with the support of the private and public sectors, and raise bilateral economic exchange to more than $3 billion. Stating that the Syrian people will not forget the Islamic Republic of Iran for standing by them during years of a terrorist war and unilateral economic sanctions on the country, Syria's Prime Minister Hossein Arnous said Iranian companies have priority to participate in the reconstruction process in Syria. The Syrian newspaper Al-Watan has also covered the same story and tells us more. Syria's economy and commerce ministry emphasized in its meeting in Tehran that the time has come to reap the fruits of cooperation between Syria and Iran. It said the agreements in the important areas of economic cooperation and investment in all sectors are at the implementation stage and are progressing well. It added, the most important thing is that what is being worked on today will lead to raising the level of economic relations to the point that the two countries aspire to. Minister of Economy and Foreign Trade of Syria, Mohammad Samer al-Khalil, said 15-year negotiations between Tehran and Damascus have now reached implementation stage. And in the past year, agreements have been signed between the two countries and are currently being carried out at a high speed. The Syrian Economy Minister, Mohammad Samer al-Khalil, was in the Islamic Republic of Iran on Saturday, 9th of December, as part of a large delegation headed by Prime Minister Hossein Arnous for the 15th meeting of the two allies' Joint Economic Commission after a long hiatus. The visit resulted in the signing of a deal on free trade and several memorandums of understanding for tourism, media, sports, museums and libraries. Iran's Minister of Roads and Urban Development, Mehrdad Basposh, said the establishment of a joint Iranian-Syrian bank has been finalized and is currently at the implementation stage. Also, the joint insurance agreed upon during President Ebrahim Raisi's visit to Damascus in May has been finalized, and the issuance of insurance policies will be activated soon. Basposh also touched on preferential tariff and many trade tariffs having been cut to zero for 88 items of goods between the two countries, saying the agreement has been finalized and is currently being implemented. They have also set a target for 50,000 Iranian pilgrims to visit Syria next year. Basposh listed energy, electricity and other key areas of collaboration, saying Iranian companies are about to help Syria repair its national electricity power grid and build new electricity-generating power plants. The London-based New Arab outlet has also covered the same story and tells us more. All indications point to the fact that agreements signed between Iran and Syria have been finalized and currently are reaching the implementation stage. The news outlet cited Yunus Al-Karim, an economic researcher, as saying, "The presence of an Iranian bank in Syria sends a message to the Arabs trying to normalize their relations with the Syrian government that the Islamic Republic of Iran has established a long-term economic presence in Syria and therefore efforts to reduce its presence in Syria have failed." He added, "Establishing a bank in Syria and strengthening cooperation, the Iranians will become strong allies of Syria and increase their influence in the country." Yunus Al-Karim, an economic researcher, also said the presence of an Iranian bank in Syria and dealing with local currencies is expected to help manage religious shrines in Syria and send pilgrims with the aim of developing tourism between the two countries. The London-based Al-Sharq Al-Osat newspaper has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Islamic Republic of Iran is pushing to activate the Iraq-Syria land transit line through Iraq, as well as shipping line between Iranian and Syrian ports. It said the project aims to revive a trade line to bypass international economic sanctions and establish what is called the East-West Corridor in Iran. The newspaper quoted economic sources in Damascus as saying that five major agreements have been concluded for the repayment of Syria's debts to Iran, which include investments in the agriculture sector, phosphate mines, oil wells, and a telecommunications project in Syria. Furthermore, Iranian President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi says Syria's resistance in the face of U.S. and Israeli regime has thwarted their plots and defeated Takfiri terrorist groups in the region. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi made the remark in a meeting with the visiting Syrian Prime Minister Hossein Arnous in Tehran on Saturday, 9th of December. President Raisi said, "The hostility of the United States and the Israeli regime towards Syria was rooted in the fact that Syria is a key member of the resistance, and the defeat of their plots, particularly regarding the collapse of the Takfiri terrorist groups, is very welcome." Elsewhere in his remarks, President Raisi pointed to deep-rooted and strategic relations between Tehran and Damascus and stressed the importance of accelerating implementation of bilateral agreements. President Raisi said Iran and Syria enjoy broad capacities to further expand bilateral cooperation in the economic, commercial, and political fields, expressing hope that the two countries would draw plans to make use of their potential as soon as possible. The Syrian Prime Minister Hossein Arnous, for his part, described his current visit to Tehran as a turning point in bilateral ties. Arnous said agreements signed between Tehran and Damascus during his trip to Tehran, particularly in the financial, banking, energy, tourism, and trade sectors, showed the two countries were determined to further strengthen their relations.
Conversation. Hi, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we take you, the audience, back to October 12, 1984. In an event that shook the British establishment, a bomb detonated at the Grand Hotel in Brighton, England, killing five people and almost killing then-British Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher. Our next guest was central to this IRA attack. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildenieu. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Pat McGee. Pat is a former member of the IRA who was jailed for the Brighton bombing in 1984. After serving 15 years, he was released under the Good Friday Agreement. Pat McGee, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sean.
Pat, before we begin, can you tell me a bit about your childhood growing up in Belfast?
Well, at the age of four, I actually left Belfast. The family moved to England. But my best memories of those years were up to the age of four. You know, very solid memories. I'm talking about, I can detail events that happened when I know I was only two. And I think growing up in England, I felt very alienated there. It wasn't a very happy childhood, I have to say that. But I was always thinking about what I'd left behind in my grandfather's house. And I think because I used to go back to it all the time in my head, it firmed up those memories. And they're among the most firm memories I have. And it was a happy time.
So, Pat, what age were you when you came back to Ireland? And, you know, what were those years like? And what motivated you to join the IRA?
Well, the family used to return to Belfast on occasions. And family members from Belfast used to visit us. We were living in a place called Norwich in England. And so I had those links, you know, and they remain quite strong. I first returned on my own, onto my own volition, when I was 19, but only for a short while. But it was specifically to see what was happening. I was concerned about what was happening as it was portrayed in the media. You just knew that you weren't getting the full story. This is before events even kicked off. Properly, as we understand it. But I came back instead at 20. And
what year was that?
That would have been 19, just after internment, so 71.
Okay.
August 71, 15th of August. It was that Sunday. Well, that Saturday night, yeah. And again, it was that desire just to see what was happening on the ground. Just before, the week before, that whole week taken up by events and over internment, you were getting a feed in the papers, and there were terrible events, and they were getting covered more than perhaps later on the press dealt with these issues. But you still knew that you weren't getting the full account. I had an aunt living in Andytown who had a phone, and I remember talking to her, and she was able to tell me that it was that bad that they had to hide behind the settee. You know, this is a gun battle in the streets in Andytown. And so, you know, they weren't covering that in the news. Mm-hmm. And so I came back just to see for myself. And I guess over a period of time, I got to see what was happening, got a better understanding of it. I would have been kind of, for example, I'd known guys, contemporaries who would have joined the British Army. And at that stage, I would have never have thought of them as Brits or had a bad view of them. But you're hearing all these accounts of what they were doing to people in the streets, you know, the abuse of people. And I couldn't square that with what I knew. Well, you see that for yourself. You're a witness to it. And I saw how people dealt with this occupation. You know, the the constant raids. Our house was raided. The messing about in the streets, etc. Just general abuse you felt in your home was occupied. Mm-hmm. And yet that community, it was a Carrickhill community, them days it was Unity Flats, you saw how they coped. And they were all doing it. Everybody seemed to me to be connected. And I just wanted to be a part of that. I wanted to be included in that. Didn't know what I could do, what my contribution could be. Really did not know. But I at least wanted to contribute in some way. Eventually, that caused me to join the IRA.
When you joined the IRA, what year was that, Pat?
1972.
1972. So the year of Bloody Sunday was the beginning, January 72. And did the likes of Bloody Sunday, was that something that motivated you, or was it what you were seeing on the streets in Belfast?
More the latter. Just an accumulation. I mean, there was no big, you know, event. And that there were many big events, but no, it was an accumulation. What was happening? The daily grind and seeing how people locally cope with that and wanting to be a part of it.
And of course, just moving on a bit, and we're going to start talking about the Brighton bomb in 1984. Can you tell me a bit about that, how you got involved in that?
Well, during internment, I was interned from 73 to 75. A lot of time to think. And how, again, it's just about what can I do? And I recognised that effectively the best we could do was to target England. Effectively, our actions, you know, with the little resources available to us, would count more there. And I thought, well, I've got a head start here. I was brought up in that. There's a lot of people around me, young lads, but I'm talking about jail, you know, internment. They've never been out of Belfast or never been out of there, you know, where they're from in the country. I had at least that. It seemed to me that put me at some sort of an advantage, you know. And so I came out of internment with a very firm view and commitment to somehow, you know, volunteer to be part of the English campaign. And I suppose the next period was achieving that end. And so eventually I was active in England. And it was seen as a campaign. Brighton, the Brighton operation, for all of its importance in terms of its targeting, was part of a campaign. We believed that the only way to get the Brits to the negotiating table was for a sustained campaign. Not one operation, no matter how significant, could achieve that. It was about getting a long-term, you know, attack in England. And I think eventually we did that after a lot of stops and starts, and I wasn't part of that. I was in jail by that stage. We'd have operated in England, withdrew because of logistics involved, and then come back to it. That wasn't a plan, the sort of pressure that was going to be needed. It took us a long time for the movement to gain what was needed. And eventually it did.
Pat, I suppose we know that the people who are operating in England or in Britain at all, there were sometimes greater risks, and certainly the way they were treated after arrest and all the rest was seemed to be pretty brutal. And I'm thinking of people like L. O'Dwyer and Martin Anderson, the Balcombe Street men. You know, there seemed to be a certain level of brutality against Irish prisoners in Britain, and innocent or not, they were all treated really badly, weren't they?
It's not quite as straightforward as that, because it was a long campaign, a long history of our people in jail in England. The real harsh days, or the early days, where it was brutal was the norm. Gradually, I think we got on top of it to the point where we were respected by screws and prisoners alike, and, you know, we established ourselves. But and you mentioned Ella and Martina. Their treatment was atrocious.
Absolutely.
That's two women isolated. They've got a harsher, much harsher regime in terms of strip searches, etc., general messing about, than any male prisoner, never mind whether Republican or otherwise. It was brutal.
So just bringing it back to the Brighton bomb in itself, can you tell me about your role in the Brighton bomb?
No, I can't really, because I don't want to. I don't want to talk about the specifics of the operation. It's just fair to say, like, that I was the person central, you know, who planted the device. But beyond that, I won't comment on it.
And will you tell us about your arrest then, and what happened after the bomb?
Well, I was arrested in Glasgow on another operation about 9 months later. And I basically walked into a sort of a trap. Somebody else was being followed. I met them and became, it was in the net, so to speak. And we led them to the rest of the people we were working with. And that's how I was arrested, June 85.
You're still tuned in to The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. Michelle Gilner, my co-host, is here.